Woods and Water, South Carolina. That's the first time I've heard the disclaimer. Hope I'm not, you know, the one who's pushing that on the station, but I can understand why they do it. Like I said, it's Woods and Water, South Carolina, Saturday afternoon. Glad you're tuned in today to 94.5 WGTK, The Answer, out of Greenville, South Carolina. Got a good show today. We're going to talk to Steve Ranella, Mediator TV. Steve, met him last year at the National Deer Alliance Quality Deer Management Convention in Louisville, Kentucky. Struck up a conversation with him before his keynote address. Just clicked. I mean, we really had a good conversation. He gave a great speech that night. And if you don't know, and we don't deal with it much in the East, but having been out west elk hunting, fishing, rambling around the mountains like we do, well aware of public lands and how much are out there. And there's 640 million acres of land out in the West. That's yours and mine. We can go hike it, walk it, fish it, hunt it, you know, write tags during hunting season. But when that is a real debate in Washington, I guess, and across state legislatures out west about who controls those lands, the states want it. I think we want it to stay in the federal, as much as I hate saying this. There is a role for the federal government in this, and this goes back to the days of Theodore Roosevelt. So Steve's going to join us. We're going to cut this first segment short. Steve will be on with us for a while today. And I hope you enjoyed it. I ask you to educate yourselves. Sportsmansaccess.org is a good place to go get some of this information. The Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership is another place. And even more than that, I encourage you to go out west and see some of it. It's a beautiful country out there, let me tell you what. You know, take a summer off the beach and plan your western trip next year. You will not regret it. Back from ICAST. I walked in last night and Taylor said, "So, Daddy, how was vacation?" I said, "What vacation?" She goes, "Well, you were in Florida for a fishing tournament." I said, "Yeah, I fished Monday. Broke a trolling motor. And, boy, it's hot in South in Orlando. Hot, humid. I don't think there are many bass in Lake Tahoe, at least none that want to really eat. We caught two on Monday. And we're fishing. Nah, I'm not the greatest fisherman out there, I'll admit that. But, I mean, we're fishing with Evan Bowell from American Bass Anglers Association. He's good. He caught one. I mean, I tied him on Monday, so I don't feel too bad. Tuesday, and it's all fun. 4 hours. It's charity tournament. Tuesday morning, oh, man, it slicked out and was hot. And, you know, I know Casey Ashley loves those kind of tournaments. I don't. And I don't like grass very much either. I mean, whether it's Kissimmee grass or reeds or cattails or hydrilla, there's no telling how many times I set the hook on a piece of hydrilla. And here's why. I'm running a speed worm on a quarter ounce weight, not pegged, and kind of a sliding Texas rig. And, of course, you'd have the initial bump, and then the weight would slide down the line, and the worm would bump, and it'd feel like a tap. Tap, and then the weight would pick up, maybe tap, and felt like a fish. Well, anyway, I caught one fish that day. I caught an 8-inch brim, and I'm famous for it because there was a fishing app, Go Free Fishing app, who was running a contest. You know, log your catch in, and then I won, a $400 Lowrance sonar unit for an 8-inch brim. Anyway, so that was my week. 16 miles in the Orange County Convention Center. A lot of good stuff out there. It's continuing to amaze every time you go to ICAST, some of the stuff that you see, some of good, some of bad. A lot of this stuff is prototype. It's not even production. I've got some stuff coming, but a lot of it won't be here until like November, December when they start actually production runs up. So Christmas could be pretty good on the show here if it gets here in time. If not, somebody's going to have a good New Year's. Well, we'll play it however. There is a duck lure out there. It looks like a little duck. It's a topwater bait. No, it did not make my best of ICAST. I mean, everybody was talking about it, but it's just not me. And I think I know why. Because I'm a duck hunter. I don't want bass eating my ducks. You know, let them eat a crankbait or a rubber worm, but, you know, leave my ducks alone because I like those during duck season. So, anyway, but it was good. I have to say, Neil, Paul, and I went down together again this year. Neil, if you're listening, I don't know whether I made him sick. I didn't feel good going down. I really don't feel good today. But I think 2 days and 100 degrees and out on the water and all. I think it took its toll on both of us. It was so bad. We cut the Costa party short Thursday night, which is just unheard of, but we did. But, Neil, if you're listening, buddy, I had a great time. Look forward to it. It's going to be back in Orlando next year. So I already got plans for next year to go back and see what else. But and it's going to be jammed up here in the next few weeks. I don't know when I'll get the best of ICAST party in, stuff in. But I'll try to get it out there as quick as I can. Like I said, a lot of it you can't buy now anyway. Let's see. Minute and a half left. Wow. What I want to get to. Okay. Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. And we're going to do more with them. They gave a great, they're the ones that helped me with it, with getting Steve on the show and all, because he's kind of their, he is one of their spokesmen, I guess you would say. And he speaks very well on the issue. They had a luncheon Wednesday on the Florida Everglades situation. Boy, that's a real mess too. If you like to fish in Florida, you may want to get involved in that one somehow or another. Bonefish and Tarpon Trust is very involved. And they're a good organization to be involved with, too. They've been here. Joe Ellen Wilson's been on here a few times about the tarpon research here in South Carolina. But meeting friends and seeing people that you see once a year is always neat. Catching up. FLW announced their schedule. I've got it here. And it's just a fun week. Everybody says, oh, how's the vacation? It's a fun time. Yeah, it is. But it's a lot of work. It's a lot of walking. It's a lot of stuff to see. But it's always fun to go down there. But it's a long week. I'm going to go home, and, man, I'm hitting the couch, and I'll probably be out for the next 2 days. That's the problem with, you know, straight down, you know, 6 o'clock wake-ups, 11 o'clock. It takes it out of you, and the heat, too. So I'm glad to be back home. Nevertheless, when I saw that, welcome to South Carolina Sign, I was, yeah, I'm home. So hang on. Steve's going to be on the other side. And listen up. There's some great information everybody needs to know. See you on the other side with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Spending too much time on the telephone. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. This show is so much fun to do, and part of the reason it's fun to do is you get to talk to all sorts of people. You meet people you never thought you would have met in your normal everyday life. One of those is Steve Rinella. I had the pleasure of meeting and talking to him back at the National Deer Alliance QDMA convention last year in Louisville. Just a really nice guy. Down to earth, basic guy who loves the outdoors. Steve, thank you for taking time all the way from Seattle to be on Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Thanks, man. I appreciate the those are kind words. I wish my wife was listening in to hear all that nice stuff.
I'll send you a copy of this, and you can replay it for
her. I'd be like, see? Not so bad.
That's right. Somebody likes me out there. like I said, I met you at the NDA convention, and we started talking bear hunting, and I was going to Canada, and you said, well, look, there's a great place in Alaska to go to Chugach Mountains, you know, right up there above the tree line and all. So when this issue came up that we're going to talk about, you were kind of the first one that popped into my head about it. It'd be a great guy to talk about because you do a lot of your hunting on public lands.
Yes, I do. My definitive moments in my life, the things that have shaped me as a writer and shaped me as a hunter and a conservationist, you know, 99% have occurred on public land, like the what I like to think of as the nation's proving grounds. And I hold public lands near and dear to my heart.
Yeah. Well, if you don't know who Steve is, real quickly, he was born up in Michigan, grew up hunting, fishing, trapping, which is, you know, something down south we don't do a whole lot of unless it's a nuisance beaver. He has a TV show, Meat Eater. He's written several books, which are really good reads. He's got a website with a bunch of podcasts on it. And if you haven't heard about him, you need to. Please check out all his stuff. But there's an issue out west, public land. The Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership is very active in this. Steve, you had a great quote that just said we need Steve on the show. Talk to us a little bit about where you came from, short introduction, And I want you to describe your show. We'll spend plenty of time on the land, but your show, I've got my own opinion of your show, but tell us about what you do in the outdoor industry.
Yeah, I started, when I got out of school, let me go, at the risk of boring everyone, I'll go back a little bit far and say I grew up hunting in a very avid hunting and fishing family. I have no recollection of beginning to hunt and fish. It was just since a very young age doing that. Like you said, I started, you know, trapping muskrats when I was 10. My professional plan all through growing up was that I was going to be a mountain man. Turned out I was 150, 200 years too late for that line of work and went into being an outdoor writer instead.
Yep.
I started writing for magazines and doing books and stuff starting in 2000. That's kind of been my primary career. And yeah, and I do a hunting television show. The show I do deals with a lot of issues of conservation and wildlife and adventure, has a strong food bent in it. Me personally, in my household, we eat wild game diet, and wild game is a big part of the show, and the hunting and fishing lifestyle is a celebration of that. And the great hunting and fishing heritage we have in this country is something that I like to touch on often. And I spend a lot of time and energy trying to articulate things about hunting and fishing that I know that all the guys I know that hunt and fish, articulating how they feel in a way that maybe they haven't taken the time to express to others. So I do try to be a, you know, a mouthpiece for the American hunter and fisherman.
And you do it very well. I must say your address at the convention was just a breath of fresh air, to tell you the truth. It really was.
Thanks, man.
And for those of you listening, I'll try to find that YouTube link and put it up on the Facebook page and the website so you can hear it too. We've got a situation out west, and I want to get to that. History of conservation out west, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, national parks, refuges, Forest Service. Give just a couple of minutes of background to kind of set up this whole discussion we're going to have.
Yeah, sure. And even before we get into it, I do want to clarify for your listeners who are in the southeast there that though this might on the surface seem like a Western issue, what we're going to be getting into when we talk about public lands, on the surface it might seem like a Western issue, but I would just implore everyone to look into this, and you will find that this is an American issue.
Yes.
It might be occurring in the Western U.S., but it's an American issue. It affects all Americans. It's part of our heritage and our destiny. And it's not just something going on halfway across the continent.
You're absolutely
but
right.
To tee it off, I'll point out a couple things.
Sure.
You know, we all, as students of American history, we all know about the great, you know, splendor of wildlife that was here when our European ancestors first, you know, arrived in the New World. We've all heard the stories, you know, Lewis and Clark and the great resources they found and passenger pigeons that blocked out the sun and herds of millions of buffalo that moved across the land like shadows of clouds. We've all heard those stories.
Right.
That, through wanton destruction, we nearly lost those resources. At the time of European contact, for instance, we had turkeys, wild turkeys, in 39 states. One of being that your state, South Carolina, was one of the last holdouts for the wild turkey. We had turkeys in only 19 states by the early 1900s.
Right.
There was, for a while, no turkey season anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We now have turkey seasons in 49 states.
Yep.
Okay, they Wisconsin shoots more turkeys in a spring than existed in 1930. Okay, so we did this radical recovery of our wildlife resources in the early 1900s.
Right.
At the forefront of that recovery, and we created the splendor we have today. I mean, America has a system of wildlife that just, when you compare it to other countries, boggles the mind, that we would have the economic wealth that we have in conjunction with the wildlife resources that we have. It's not by accident. So in the 1930s, we had a great array of conservation issues come up with people trying to stop the disappearance of fish and game and stop the destruction of resources and destruction of habitat. And out of that came a few things. The game and fish system we have now, state management of wildlife resources, managed in perpetuity for future generations. And what also came out of it is a phenomenal federal public lands program We all know and celebrate Theodore Roosevelt. He's there on Mount Rushmore. I think that if you were to go and poll a bunch of Americans, ask them to list a handful of the greatest presidents, you'd find almost unanimity about the importance of Theodore Roosevelt. Okay, he was instrumental in laying out the federal public lands system that we have now, by which we have 640 million acres of this country are owned by all Americans. Me, you, everyone listening to this program has equal access and effectively holds deed to 640 million acres of land.
And they can
access, a lot of this occurs in the West, but it's not exclusively Western by any stretch.
Yeah, and they can access that land for nothing, for the tank, the cost of a tank of gas to get wherever they need to go. They don't have to have a license to access these lands.
No, it's like a guy like me who grew up, like I grew up Manistee National Forest in Michigan. Okay, I grew up just a couple miles from its southern terminus. My perspective on that stuff growing up was that it just fell from the skies. Okay, it was just there, right? And you took it for granted because it was just there.
Right.
I think that some Americans have that perspective where they look at this great abundance, 640 million acres of land at their disposal to hunt on, to fish on, to explore on, camp on, go ATVing on. Just, it's there for you. I think a lot of people take it for granted. Some people don't know it's there, but it's just mind-boggling to think about the volume of land and the value of that land that is for all Americans,
right,
to use equally. And again, yes, the bulk of that land, there's no cost associated with going there. You don't need to go down when you're going out on national forest land or going out on Bureau of Land Management land. You don't need to go down and file a permit. You don't need to ask someone's permission. You don't need to check if it's okay this Wednesday. In a large measure, you don't need to go like, but can I camp there? Can I camp there? It is the definition of freedom, public lands. I have wandered on and hunted and fished on and derived my food from public lands, federal public lands in many, many states.
Yeah.
It's like I have invaluable personal wealth when you think about the amount of land I have access to. It's just as simple as getting in a car, getting on a plane, getting on a bike, depending where you live, and just going there and going. It is. It's the definition of freedom of our federal public lands.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, when talking about this, just to tee off before we get into the current controversy, I think just for people to sit and just try to comprehend for a minute what it means that they own all this land. Any one of your listeners can go out right now and get the necessary tags and go camp and stay on this land.
Yeah.
I mean, get the necessary tags. I'm talking about like getting a hunting tag if they want to go hunting and go out, and it's theirs for the taking.
Yeah. The only measure you might want to take is let somebody know where you're going.
Sure. Yeah. There's some safety issues you might want to do. Let someone know where you're going for sure. But the point is that I'm trying to make is it's there for free for use. And so when we're going to be getting into this discussion and we're talking about the future and fate of this 640 million acres, I just want to make it abundantly clear to everyone that we're not talking about some abstract notion. We're talking about something that you effectively hold deed to. It's yours.
Yep. That's correct.
We're talking about the fate of your property.
Yep.
So, you know, with that, let's continue. But I think that, you know, I think that's something that we should make abundantly clear right off the bat.
And well made, but there's an issue. State control versus right now it's held on the federal side. Western states won't control that land, and that's essentially the debate we're having.
Yeah. So this debate comes up in various forms throughout American history, and I'll lay out the debate. But before I lay out the debate, I'm going to make one last point. You know, we talk about Theodore Roosevelt's importance here. And earlier you mentioned, you know, a conservation group that takes its name from Theodore Roosevelt, which is the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, who is at the forefront of this issue, defending hunting and fishing rights and access rights for Americans. When Roosevelt did his work, he pointed out that this is not merely to the people now alive, but this is to the unborn people, to those in the womb of time. So his inclination, like when he started the public lands program, he already knew and said that this is for future generations in perpetuity. He didn't mean that it's just for this one right now to liquidate it. But that's kind of what we're hearing rumblings of. There is legislation making its way through Washington right now to take enormous chunks of our federal land, federal public lands, and turn them over to state management. Now, proponents of this movement are going to tell you that local interests know better, and this will give a more nuanced management strategy to better suit the people most affected by the land. But there's a little more at play here, because what we're looking at is we're looking at a handful of political activists who want to give economic control. They want to take economic control of these federal lands away from the broader American public and hand it to a handful of individuals who are positioned to make short-term profits from it. The idea of states holding land is not new. So we have 11 Western states. When they became states, they were granted enormous amounts of public land, enormous amounts of land that was held by the federal government, and they were handed this land. So 11 Western states were given 64.2 million acres of land when they became states. So far, they've sold off to private interests 25.4 million acres. So they've sold off, you know, about almost 40% of the public lands that they were given. Now you have a lot of states and political activists and other forms of lobbyists saying, like, oh, we should give the states a bunch more. And they're saying that it'll just, the only difference being that it'll just be held as state land. But I think that Americans, regardless of where you live, need to realize that you do not get greater freedoms by handing lands to state control. In general, states are far more restrictive about land use and far more restrictive about keeping land open to the public, open to the American people, than the federal government. Now, let me know if I can just keep going, or if you want, now, do you want to butt in here? Is all this being clear, you think?
Yeah, it's great. I'm just listening. I don't invite guests on the show to hear myself talk over them, so I'm just listening. You carry right along.
So let me give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about.
Go ahead.
Now, in Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Montana, for instance, camping on state lands is restricted to the extent where in some places you cannot camp overnight on some state lands. Not true with your federal lands. Off-road vehicle use is, so ATV on state lands, prohibited. Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, New Mexico. Recreational shooting, okay? Going out and doing some plinking with your .22, sighting in your hunting rifle. Prohibited on state lands, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico. Okay? Because the states are operating under a very different mandate than the federal government is. States are operating on this thing where they need to take their land. State land needs to be managed for revenue in the most immediate sense. It needs to be managed for revenue in the immediate sense. Oftentimes, because the state has that mandate, oftentimes what they find is that they're going to open it up to resource extraction, and they don't have to have the burden of having it be allowed, having it be open to other multiple uses. So if hunting or camping or fishing or shooting obstructs commercial activities, they just nix that part of the equation and leave it open to just commercial aspects. Because on federal land, they have to, by law, required by law to manage for multiple uses, grazing, mining, logging, hunting, camping,
okay,
exploration, wandering around. You can't let one outright prohibitively negate the other. A state can. So not only can they sell it, they can put very arduous restrictions on public use. They know that this is happening, but they're not too comfortable articulating what it's going to look like, because they're just trying to sell this idea of local control.
Right.
Even though it's reckless, they're trying to act like it's somehow a better, more preferable system when in fact it's a much more complicated issue than proponents of this plan are letting on.
Something you said right there, the local control, you know, that's it's almost a conservative approach. You know, everything conservative is better held close to home where you can manage it and all that. But in this case, that's not for the benefit of the American public.
No, I don't think so. I'm a conservative person, okay? Yeah. I have a retirement account. Now, every time I feel like a little economic pinch or I wish I could go buy something that I can't quite afford, do I go and, like, liquidate my retirement account for short-term gain?
No,
of course I don't. We're sitting on an enormous public reserve that has infinite value. And I want to talk about the value aspect for a minute because this goes beyond dollars and cents.
Okay.
But we're sitting on some of the most pristine pieces of wilderness left in the world. There's a value to it in the terms of, like, what it would actually worth if you went and sold it. There's all this other value that's inestimable. You can't even begin to fathom it, what its implications are for clean air and clean water. Most drinking water, you know, originates on federal public lands in the high country, okay?
Okay.
What it means for wildlife. So there's things you can't put a dollar figure on. But there's also this idea that as the world becomes more exploited and more developed, and as the private lands in our country and the state lands on our country become more exploited, more developed, you're only going to have a stronger contrast between the developed and tame world and the wild, pristine world. We are holding right now for future generations the best vestiges we have of wild, pristine nature. Its value is going to climb exponentially in coming decades and centuries. It would be economically foolish in my mind to go like, oh yeah, but I could make a couple bucks off that right now. Let's start dumping this stuff. That's directly against my understanding of being fiscally and economically conservative. It's not blowing through things when you feel when you sniff a quick opportunity that's going to be shooting yourself in the foot in the long term. And to say some more things about value, I think it's important. I don't know, you know, where I grew up, a very influential thinker was Aldo Leopold. I don't know, you know, if he's widely read in South Carolina, but he had spent a lot of time in the West, had spent a lot of time in the Great Lakes region. And he talked about, even in the 1930s, he's talking about this notion that we have become almost like economic hypochondriacs, where we're so worried about our fiscal wealth that we're incapable of being well.
Right.
I think that it's fine to say, yeah, man, we have some federal public lands that are extremely valuable, and we're keeping them tight to our chest because we're playing the long game here. We're running out of pristine wilderness. We're running out of places that generate clean air and clean water, and these are what we're holding on to for the future. For those, like Roosevelt said, still, you know, in the womb of time.
Sure. Keep going. Okay, habitat and access. This is something that here in South Carolina we have the Take One, Make One program. We have an archery in schools program here. It's all geared towards getting kids involved. Clemson Research. Clemson University is right now doing some research, and have been for the past year, on, you know, Take One, Make One is that age group, you know, 12 to 16, 17, maybe single household parents or don't have any opportunity to do that. And so you have a mentor program and they take them out hunting once and all.
Yeah.
Clemson University is actually doing that on the college level, which has the potential to be more successful because the college age kids, you know, they have some disposable income, they have means of transportation, and they can find access. But if you talk to anybody involved in hunting and fishing, habitat and access, and we have that in those 640 million acres. And of course, you doing most of your hunting and all and on public land, and here in the South, of course, you know, there's not a whole lot of it. There's some national forest, but most everybody here that deer hunts is a member of a club or, you know, something like that. For somebody here in the South and you vast knowledge of hunting out West, just give me a couple of hunts that somebody here could plan and do. I know I've done them, but I want to hear you talk about them. Couple of hunts.
I'd like to touch on that, but I'd like to touch on something you brought up too, just about access and getting future generations excited about the natural world.
Go ahead.
And involved in hunting and fishing.
Yeah.
Anyone who, let's say you like to hunt, and I know many of your listeners do. 95% of Americans aren't engaged in what we're doing.
Correct.
Okay. You know, 95% of Americans don't hunt. Now, for hunters to maintain our political clout and to have our say in preserving fish and wildlife habitat and to have power, we need to have our numbers be maintained. We can't afford to become a dying breed and have it be that we have fewer people who care about fish and wildlife, fewer people who care about wild lands. We need to keep our advocacy level up. Hunters have always been at the forefront of conservation movement. Again, going back to Roosevelt, his experiences as a hunter are what inspired him to do the phenomenal work that he did. Aldo Leopold was a hunter. Pinchot was a hunter. Mm-hmm. Okay, our early conservationists all came from that. Anyone who hunts and fishes knows that being out on the land inspires you to become a protector of the land. So we need to bolster and grow, continue to grow hunter numbers and hunter engagement. One of the biggest things that impedes hunter growth and hunter engagement is a feeling that there's no place to go. Now, you mentioned mentor programs. I know a lot of guys who have been involved with mentor programs where they'll go out and find a farmer, and the farmer will host a mentor program on his land, and a mentor will take a first-time hunter out, maybe from an urban area or suburban area, and they'll take him out on a hunt, and they'll get a turkey on private land. Oftentimes, they wind up, after that event, being like, I'm hooked, man. I'm sold. You're right. This is the greatest thing in the world. I want in. But they don't have a place to go. That remains one of the biggest obstacles to getting in to the outdoor lifestyle, is assuming that you don't have a place to do it. Now, that's largely a measure of perception, because we do have immense reserves of places to hunt and fish, but people don't know about them, or they don't have direct access to them because of where they live specifically.
Yep.
But we can't, on one hand, be talking about preserving our hunting and fishing heritage and preserving our wildlands and our fish and wildlife resources. We can't talk about the importance of that while at the same time have this conversation about reducing or outright eliminating many of the places where Americans are allowed to go and do that for free. Because our public land system is like a direct repudiation of the European system. Everyone, I'm sure all your listeners are familiar, like, you know Robin Hood.
Yeah.
The Robin Hood story is you had the king own the land, the king owned the game. People weren't allowed to go get it. Robin Hood was a poacher in that he went out on the king's land to hunt. The European system is this idea that the wealthy few, those connected to the royalty, own the land, and the people stay off it. They don't touch the resources. We stand against that because, you know what, we're like a better country. We're a bolder country. We do bigger, better things for our people. So we know the importance of that. And for us to turn around and say, yeah, man, we got to keep that heritage, that conservation ethic alive, but at the same time, let's dissolve some of our public lands so a handful of global, multinational corporations can make some quick bucks off it.
Yeah.
It's absurd to me that the conversation has gone this far.
Why do you think it's gone this far?
I think it's gone this far because people are able to harness into some antipathy or some apathy people have about the federal government. I think it's easy right now to look at some things the federal government is doing, to look at some efficiencies in the federal government, and take that anger that voters and Americans might have with some aspects of the federal government and span it out to say that the feds don't do anything right. When in fact, federal land management predates by a long shot some of the issues that people are having with the federal government in the current political climate. So I think that shrewd marketers, are able to take this idea where they want to get their hands on land, okay, because they want to make money off it for themselves, or they want to help, like I said, multinational corporations make money off American land. or help the wealthy few acquire large blocks of land that's now held by the American people. They're able to take this idea and market it and put it on as a rider to go along with some displeasure that people are having with aspects of the federal government right now. I think it's just like it's opportunism.
I think you're exactly right.
And they're selling a short-sighted notion. They're selling this idea that, oh, if the states just had it, we'd all make a lot more money. But really, let's kind of look at that.
Okay.
There's talk of Idaho taking over like 16 million acres of land. What are they going to do when there's a forest fire? Just forest fighting alone on 16 million acres of land is going to put them into a deficit of about $111 million annually.
Yeah.
In forest fires. So what happens when the taxpayers of Idaho, which has a relatively small population compared to many other states, what happens when they get harnessed with that bill? They're going to dump it.
Sure. That's economics.
So I think that anyone sitting there, whether you're in South Carolina or Maine or New Mexico, so they're looking, you don't need that like great of a crystal ball to look and kind of see where this is going. Where this is going, where Americans are going to wind up with less freedom of movement, less involvement and say in a resource that's already theirs. They're basically saying to go along with this legislation, you're basically coming out and saying, yeah, you know what? Reduce my access, reduce my freedom, reduce my say in the interest of outside parties making money is what this is about. If you're serious about fighting this thing, I mean, there's a handful of things to do. I would first and foremost, man, I'm a person who, like, I believe in being educated about issues, okay? I believe in learning both sides to things. And when I look at an issue, before I go and speak out on it, I like to understand very well both sides. I like to get to a point where I can deliver both sides just as well.
And
I think it's a disservice. I think it's a disservice as an American to hold an opinion on one side of an issue without being able to articulate clearly the other side of the issue.
Yeah.
So I implore your visitors, your listeners, please go out and read anything you can get your hands on about this issue. But included in that, I would go to the website sportsmanaccess.org.
Yeah.
Sportsmanaccess.org. And go read that in addition to the other things. I'm telling you, this piece of information that I'm putting forward is arguing what I'm arguing, but it puts it in pretty clear figures and numbers that anyone can understand. Don't just restrict your research to this, but very important, check this out. If in the end you agree with what I'm saying about the importance of our public lands heritage, sign the petition that you're going to find there. And that's the best step. And you got to let your lawmakers know that you do not want them squandering your personal wealth that you hold in the form of federal public lands.
Yeah, I did it. And it was as simple as typing in my name, address, and that's it. I mean, Senator Tim Scott wants our phone numbers, so I guess he can make sure the area code's in South Carolina. But it was a painless petition to sign.
Yeah, please, man, check it out. But don't just take my word for it.
Yeah,
look into it, and I wouldn't say this if I wasn't confident about what your findings will be. If I wasn't confident what your findings would be, I would be trying to just like say like, no, just take my word for it. No need to go read about it. Please go read about it, because you're only going to find that what I'm saying is going to agree with the vast majority of the people listening to this thing right now. If you love to hunt and fish,
yeah,
this is, I mean, it's a two-sided issue, sure, but it's like, The information is overwhelming when you look at it, that our best bet is to continue the legacy laid down by Roosevelt and maintain strong, healthy, well-funded federal public lands.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I've read both sides of it. I tell you, the clincher for me was, and we didn't touch on it for very long, but the financial side of it. States, they just don't have the ability to take over, manage, control, upkeep. You mentioned forest fires; they don't have that kind of revenue stream.
No, we have a $646 billion outdoor industry. That's $646 billion spent by outdoor recreationalists. For the states, okay, we keep talking about what's best for the states.
Yeah.
The states are pulling $80 billion in tax revenue off of this.
Yeah.
6 million recreation jobs coming out of federal public lands? I can't believe we hadn't brought it up till now. I would love to talk the economics of it.
Yeah.
The only time I get reluctant to talk the economics of it is when I'm reluctant to engage in this idea that federal lands, that our public lands have to answer for themselves on a daily basis in terms of dollar figures.
Right. It goes way beyond that,
and it's much bigger than that. So I'm a little reluctant to say, like, oh, yeah, if you run the numbers, it makes financial sense. Sure, it absolutely makes financial sense.
Yeah.
But it's a bigger issue than that. Roosevelt talked about it being a bigger issue than that. He talked about it as though it was a matter of freedom.
Or a moral
freedom
issue.
Freedom to move.
Or a moral. Conservation of Theodore Roosevelt was a moral issue.
Yeah. Moral, ethical, and he had a pretty solid notion of what America required and the kind of people that he wanted the Americans to be. And he felt that them having access to land to roam was important to that. And he even said, it's valuable, sure, but it's a bigger issue than money. It's a bigger issue than money right now. It's like we have to, hunters and fishermen, sportsmen, hikers, everyone has to come out and make their voice heard that we're not going to entertain these silly stopgap, knee-jerk fiscal maneuvers in order to enrich a handful of people. You know, we're not going to go down that path, man, and we got to let people know and make a hard stand on it.
Well, I think anyone that is listening to this, who will listen to the podcast, who will talk to someone who listens to this show, I think they'll get that message loud and clear. I think, like I said.
Thanks, Matt. Well, I appreciate you having me on to talk about it.
Hey, we didn't get to a lot of the other stuff I'd love to talk to you about, so we need to do this again one day.
Anytime. You got my number. You call me up.
I'll do it, Steve. Steve Rinella, Meat Eater TV. Buy his books. Look at his website. And like you said, do your research on this. And when you come up with your decision, you follow through with what you think needs to be done. Steve, I appreciate you coming on. I really appreciate Kristen at Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership for hooking us up together. And we'll talk soon.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks, Steve. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Wow. You know, normally I like to take something my guests say in Rabbit Trail. I don't expect my guests to take something I say in Rabbit Trail. What more do you say? I encourage you to go, like Steve said, do your own research. And I know this has got little or nothing to do with South Carolina. As we live here and look forward to deer season, open August 15th or September 15th or October the 1st, 11th, you know. But some issues are bigger than just this state. And that's one of them. Because if you ever want to go out there, it will be very important to you. And I put up links for both of those on the Facebook page, both Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership and sportsmansaccess.org. And since we're just, we've already blown the South Carolina Woods and Water part apart, I love aviation. Very few of you out there probably don't know that. Tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. is something that epic. I don't know. Tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. in Wichita, Kansas, at McConnell Air Force Base, you're going to have a B-29 take off for the first time since 1952. Little timeline, March 1945, dock. Fuselage number 44-69972 was delivered to the U.S. Army. That was 5 months before two atomic bombs ended World War II. July 51, Doc was assigned to radar calibration duty. And March a year later, Doc ended up on a bombing range in China and at China Lake, California. 1987, Tony Mazzolini found Doc and began plans to remove it and restore her to flying status. Take 12 years before he got a team to take possession of the aircraft from the U.S. government. They moved it out of the desert in 88. In 1990, they got it flatbedded to a facility at Wichita, Kansas, the Boeing facility there.
they have spent the last 16 years, volunteer years, restoring Doc to flying status. I know it was back in March or something. They did the initial engine run-ups on all four of those engines. And it's been a process of them getting FAA approval, airworthiness certificates for a fuselage. Our plane has essentially been redone, refabricated from ground up after 50-something years in the desert. So tomorrow morning, 9:30, you can go to www.b-29doc.com. They're going to try to fly her. She will become the second airworthy B-29 out there. Fifi is the other one. I've seen Fifi numerous times up at Oshkosh, Wisconsin, the EAA fly-in. So, yeah, it's not much about hunting and fishing, but, boy, is it all about history. So, now, it is the McConnell Air Force Base is graciously let them use their runways. It's dependent on weather. But as of the latest press release I got from the DOC group, they're still on for 9:30 in the morning Eastern time. Just something you probably don't want to miss if you're around a computer and can watch a piece of history take back to the skies. It's just incredible. I can't imagine how many miles of wiring is in a B-29 Super Fortress. Pretty incredible. Wow. Short show today. Hope you enjoyed it. FLW tournament's coming up. I'll have a preview of that next week or so. In the meantime, find some time to get out there. Had to take interstates. No back roads to Orlando, Florida this week. So, and don't forget that camera. We'll see you next week here on Woods and Water, South Carolina.